Hello and a very warm welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London with me, Hugo MacDonald. Ahead in the next hour, we'll be visited by Space Copenhagen, the Danish studio that combines practical product making with off-the-wall art events to create the complete design experience. And we'll be visiting the Urban Age City Planning Conference taking place today in Hong Kong. Speaker at the event, Christine Lowe, spoke about Hong Kong life with Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck.
We rank very high in terms of longevity, child mortality, and, you know, basically people feeling safe in the city and that they have access to all kinds of amenities. And these serves Hong Kong very well.
And keeping it in the city, but on a different buzz entirely, we'll be hearing from a London beekeeper and Sarah Ichioka, director of the Architecture Foundation, which recently launched a competition to design some homes for our streetwise birds and bees. All that and some great tunes right here in the next 60 minutes on Midori House. But first, let's get the latest news from around the world with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. Former Prime Minister Mario Monti was sworn in today as... European Commissioner Mario Monti was sworn in today as Italy's new Prime Minister. Mr. Monti has formed a new technocratic government to face a major debt crisis threatening the entire Eurozone. Monti said he hoped international markets would be placated by the installation of the new government and said he would himself take the crucial economy portfolio. Earlier, Enrico Giovannini, the head of Italy's statistics agency, said that Monti's efforts alone may not be enough to rescue the country from a crisis.
We need really to take tough decisions, not only on the public finance, but also on this industrial policy, on the equity, for example, the tax evasion policy.
Greece's new coalition government, led by Prime Minister Lucas Papademos, has secured enough votes to win a parliamentary vote of confidence, as expected. The majority of MPs from Greece's two main parties and their far-right coalition partners backed the new unity government tasked with saving Greece from default. The US President Barack Obama is currently touring Australia. While attending a banquet in Canberra, he spoke of his concern at the Eurozone crisis.
The larger European community has to stand behind the European project. And for those American readers or listeners and those Australian readers or listeners, I think we all understand at this point, we've got an integrated world economy. What happens in Europe will have an impact on us.
Syrian television has showed thousands rallying in the port city of Latakia to mark the day President Bashar al-Assad's father came to power and to protest against the Arab League's decision to suspend the country's membership. Assad's father, Hafez al-Assad, seized power in 1970. Arab foreign ministers were meeting in Rabat today after Syria's suspension from the Arab League took effect. Syria's chair was empty as an Arab-Turkish forum got underway in the Moroccan capital. France has recalled its ambassador from Syria and is working with the Arab League on a new draft United Nations resolution against Damascus. Pro-government Syrian crowds have attacked France's honorary consulate in Latakia and diplomatic offices in Aleppo, as well as the Turkish, Saudi Arabian and United Arab Emirates embassies in Damascus. US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton pledged a further $10 million in aid to flood-ravaged Thailand today when she met Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra in Bangkok. Part of the latest package will go towards helping to reopen Bangkok's flooded airport to help with delivery of aid to other areas of the country.
Assessment teams are on the ground now to prepare for U.S. contributions to help Thailand restore vital infrastructure and services and address public health needs. We are providing direct medical services and improving hospital readiness.
A poet and academic from Russia's volatile region of Chechnya was found dead today outside a Moscow apartment building in what investigators said appeared to be a contract killing. Ruslan Akhtakhanatov was shot in the head in northern Moscow around midnight before his killer escaped in a car. They later found the burnt-out vehicle on the southern edge of the city. An Islamist insurgency rooted in those wars is still raging in Chechnya and much of the rest of the North Caucasus. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Nick. Now let's take a quick look at the global weather with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
And the autumn chill from Eastern and Central Europe is spreading to Western countries now. From Moscow to Budapest and now into parts of France and Belgium, more frosty nights on the way. By day, though, still mild in the very far west of Europe. Thursday's city forecast, Prague, 3 degrees and cloudy. In Oslo, it's a cold zero, misty. In Brussels, 10 Celsius, partly cloudy. And in London, 13 only just, and partly cloudy as well. Over to North America, and rain and storms are crossing the eastern half of the United States through Wednesday. The eastern seaboard will be particularly wet and unpleasant during Thursday. It's already been raining quite heavily in New York City. Here's Thursday's city forecast, and we'll start with Canada. Vancouver, 5 Celsius, rain, wind and some wet snow. In San Francisco, 17 degrees and sunny. In Washington, 10 degrees. And after a wet Wednesday, the sun should be back on Thursday. And finally, Atlanta, 15 Celsius with showers. Let's head to Australia now. And it's Sydney. It's been cool, cloudy and wet. More of that to come on Thursday. However, over the weekend in Sydney, it'll become sunny and considerably hotter. Mid-30s over the weekend in Sydney. Here's the city forecast for Australia. Sydney, at the moment on Thursday, 21, rain showers. Melbourne, 24, partly sunny. Brisbane, 29 with some sunshine. And in Perth, 24 degrees and just a few showers. That's it. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Thomas. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. The time's approaching 7 minutes past the hour. In a moment, we'll be hearing from auctioneers Philips de Puri about Nordic design and just how tidy a sum those clean lines can fetch. Stay tuned.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse é Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, ragazzi.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, e io cosa?
Tämä on Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24. Now, you don't have to be an expert in design to know that our friends in the Nordic region do it very well indeed. The mid-century Scandinavian period has arguably had more of an impact on modern design than any other. Designs from this era are still the most sought after and collectible on the planet. An auction takes place tomorrow at Philips de Puri in London called Important Nordic Design, and it's the first time the auction house has delved into this period. I was joined in the studio earlier by Alexander Payne, design director of Philips de Puri, to hear about the sale and find out if the hunger for Nordic design will ever abate. So, Alexander, I wonder if you could tell me why you feel important Nordic design is a good auction to have now.
It's certainly something that we wanted to pay full attention to.
The sale is split up into Swedish, Finnish, Danish, is that right?
That's correct, yeah. We looked at the three areas. We looked at, and also a theme that is running through the catalogue, as we see on the catalogue cover, we have the three flags of the nations. And as Lee Mendel, who's curating the sale with Philips, points out that obviously there is this common flag and common form that connects each of the cultures, but equally each one of these countries has its very, very specific identity. And we wanted to showcase that. We wanted to show Finland, where it is inspired by nature. Nature is all around it. It hasn't been ruled by a monarchy. It's a country that obviously has had a lot of historical influences and turmoil, but it's something that it is always looking to the landscape and to the nature to inform it. Sweden, obviously, a much more neoclassically based country. We wanted to pull that in through the architecture and through the forms and really show that style and type of design. And then Denmark, the country of the master cabinet maker. Again, we wanted to show that quality of detail and how it's always about the best of the best.
And how do you go about sourcing products for something like this? I mean, to me it seems like an enormous collection. There's 120 lots, is that right?
Yeah, 122 lots. 122. Spanning from jewellery textiles, glass, furniture and lighting. And we didn't want to present a stereotype kind of showcase of this
another egg chair.
Exactly. When we showcased a designer and architect, we wanted to show the finest example that we could possibly find by that designer or architect. So over a year of preparation, Lee Mendel has been spending a lot of time and made a lot of journeys into Scandinavia. He's very, very passionate about the area. And his photographs actually take us through the sale catalogue on a journey through his inspiration and his enlightenment, as it were, into this region. So we wanted to use those as connections through each culture.
And if you were to focus on sort of one or two very surprising things that you're hoping are going to be the star lots, what would you point me to?
I think I'd point you to the new architects and designers that certainly I discovered on this journey, architects and designers which, whilst in the design and architecture kind of historical volumes on this region, but people that maybe we haven't actually paid so much attention to within certainly the United Kingdom and Europe and United States, where most of our market is coming from. People like Wilhelm Lauritsen, a very celebrated architect in Denmark. Some of the most important national buildings have been designed by him, including the radio broadcasting house, the airport. And Lauritsen, we've got three exceptional pieces in the auction, one of which is a beautiful chandelier, which he designed for the Danish residence of the Danish ambassador for the United States of America. This is a beautiful object, and what's lovely, this is, through objects like this, we are introducing this design to different collector bases. People who maybe have looked at French or looked at Italian or contemporary design have actually come in and seen these new designs to them and been very, very influenced. Also, from Sweden, we have Gunnar Erik Asplund, obviously one of the champions of Swedish design, and we have an incredibly important armchair by Asplund, which again, both collector and museum interests will, I'm sure, be seen on this object. And Finland, Tapio Virkkala, beautiful jewellery. Again, we don't see a lot of Tapio Virkkala jewellery. It's so, so, so rare. And we have three exceptional examples.
And talking about the people who might be collectors, you mentioned that you're trying to introduce this to people who possibly haven't looked at this region to collect before. Where, like, what are the sort of markets that you see people collecting from that maybe you haven't in the past?
Yes, I'm seeing certainly a lot of modern art and contemporary art collectors looking at the Nordic regions. It's an area that is both very sympathetic and responds very, very well to our collections. It's something that is responding beautifully to so many people's homes and architecture, and especially in Europe. We see so many homes that this type of work works so well from. And then actually we've had clients who, up till now, have been maybe focusing on French mid-century design, the designs of Charles Perriand, Jean Prouvaire, and they're wanting to expand their collections through looking at some of the greats from across the other side of Europe.
And I want to pick up on something you mentioned there about the fact that these, I mean, possibly what ties Nordic design together as a region and a period is the fact that all of this furniture fits into a home. It's very practical. Mm. It might carry quite a hefty price tag for original and rare pieces, but they're still things that you would want to live with. And to me, that's why the period has been so consistently popular. Does it, I mean, in your mind, is there ever a point at which, when you start seeing egg chairs in your local estate agent or your fast food chain, that it might get too much and that people might start turning their backs on this?
No, I think that's a very, very valid point. But I think that's why, when we approached this subject, that we didn't want to go for the norm. That we wanted to see and show people the connection of this is why Scandinavian Nordic design is so important to us, and this is why it is infiltrated into so many parts of our life. It is because of these great architects and designers. We wanted to celebrate the craftsmen. Really, for people to actually even understand that in Denmark, the master cabinet maker is more celebrated than the architect and designer. These are the people who are really the true heroes of the production and the way that these objects are designed. And I think that we felt, as long as we showed works that had a broad price range, estimates, you know, starting from the £1,500 mark, going up into, you know, the £100,000 plus market, that we appealed to all reaches of collectors. We gave the young first-time collector huge opportunities to invest and to be excited into this market. And ultimately, this is an area which instills passion in the collector, and people want to become part of it. And as you say, it is so relevant today. It has been so relevant in the past. And my feeling is that this is the sleeper and the silent market that will continue to prevail for many, many years to come.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. I'll be there in the front row with my paddle.
Thank you. I look forward to seeing you.
That was Philips de Puri's Alexander Payne talking to me earlier today. Up next, we'll be staying in the Nordic region with a visit from Space Copenhagen, the all-inclusive design studio with a can-do Danish approach. Back after the break. In fact, there's time for a quick song, I think. We're going to be listening to Seven by Fever Ray.
For a concise and sharply edited overview of the best clips, quotes and quips of the week, tune into The Curator every Sunday here on Monocle 24. Hosted by a different guest editor every edition, The Curator will point you to all the programmes you might have missed and is also the perfect digest of the week in world affairs, business, culture and design. The Curator, in association with Rolex, right here on Monocle 24.
Every Saturday, Monocle's editors team up with a lively mix of guests to take a leisurely look back at the week past and pull out their personal highlights, cultural, political, musical, cinematic, and more. Our Saturday show is the perfect accompaniment to the weekend papers and a good coffee. The Review comes to you in association with J. Crew every Saturday at 11 a.m. London time, right here on Monocle 24, and is also available on our timeshift player on monocle.com and on iTunes.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. Now, for such a small country, Denmark has produced more household design names than any other. This has been a mixed blessing for a young generation of designers. You might argue they've struggled to live up to the benchmark set by names like Arne Jacobsen, Hans Wegner and Werner Panton. But there's a new breed of firms that are making waves, designing more than chairs. Studios combining product design with interior design, exhibition design and art direction are proving Denmark still has what it takes to be a leader on the world stage. I'm joined now by the pioneers of this new approach, Signe Bindslev Henriksen and Peter Bundegaard Rutso, founders of Space Copenhagen, to tell us a bit more. Welcome, Peter and Signe.
Great to be here.
Thank you.
I wonder if you could start maybe just by explaining what you do exactly. I mean, I know that you have been the designers behind some of Copenhagen's more famous restaurants, but you're much more than just interior designers. Peter?
Well, you know, it's to give you a straight up description of what we do is I think not completely possible. I think we have certain approaches, but we started out some time ago sort of coming out of architecture school, and I have certain ideas about how everything was put together. And after working, I think, the both of us quite a while, we sort of realized that the world is changing. It's not uniform in the way it used to be in terms of how things look, how shape and style should be approached. So I think our approach these days are that it's one project at a time, and it's without a preconceived sort of idea of how it looks. It's about looking into the sense of dialogue with the people we work for and sort of keeping the ability to look carefully into whether we're right for a project and what are the grounds for us accepting or getting engaged. And then concentrating on the dialogue and having that dialogue sort of point in the right direction.
So it's still sort of problem solving in quite a traditional sense, but across a much wider variety of things. It's not just I've made a beautiful chair that is something I want to live with forever. It's about speaking with clients across a complete range of different sort of disciplines to fulfill what they are looking for. Maybe they don't even know that. Is that right?
Well, I mean, the thing is that we've been really lucky that we also founded our architect office at a point in time where there was like this wave going on in Copenhagen of new energy, also in the sense of other creative areas, such as, for instance, the restaurant scene. So we've actually been lucky that we from the beginning were appointed to do some of these really interesting projects with really interesting characters, with people who actually had an idea of who they were, what they wanted to do in a market where aesthetics and surroundings also played a great role. And the thing is that that kind of that energy and that dynamic feel that they created in their universe has been an extremely inspiring ground for us to play in, so to speak. I mean, because basically what we do is to try to create a space where they are going to live there for the next many years after we have fulfilled our project, which means that we need to interpret what they want to succeed with when they go to work every day. So that of course also looks different from place to place, because it's basically a very personal experience for all of them.
I want to pick up on something you said there about you feel like there was part of a sort of wave in the restaurant industry. Mm-hmm. And I mean, perhaps the restaurant all of our listeners might be familiar with is Noma, that mm-hmm. you designed the interior mm-hmm. of.
Yes.
But it's not just really restaurants either, is it? There seems to be a new wave in the last 5-6 years of architects, designers, chefs, musicians who are all sort of shackled or dropping the shackles of the sort of huge names that I mentioned in the introduction to this piece, who dominated sort of the global scene in the 60s and 70s. Do you feel like you are all sort of helping each other then in some sense?
Well, definitely. I think the... So the conception of Scandinavian or Danish design is such a large heritage that it's probably taken the time that it had to take to sort of break it a little bit, but also realizing that it has to be a certain amount of new energy reflecting what goes on now and sort of is in tune with what comes naturally between people, and it's this curiosity that exists where people inspire each other and have that dialogue transform into design, into furniture, into emotion, and I think finally the time is there to sort of distance yourself from this old school picture of how design is conceived in a Scandinavian context. And the thing is that when you look at what is Scandinavian design, it's a question that's really hard to answer, actually, when you look into it, because you always get stuck, whether it's Arne Jacobsen, it's the egg, or it's the swan, or it's something like that. And what we've been discussing is it's not really the iconic emblem of the design, it's more how they were thinking. I mean, Arne Jacobsen went to the States to visit Eames, and he saw what he was doing with the shapes and the forms, and he just basically came back and said, "We're going to do one." So it's like that. So it's this picking up things that just turn on your curiosity, that you transform, take out of context, and transform into a new scene and attach new values to it. And I think when that flows naturally, things will happen. And it just seems like it has a natural new beginning in Copenhagen at the moment on a lot of creative levels, actually.
And I said that you do more than just design furniture, but actually one of your most recent projects that you've been working on has been a new range of furniture. That's quite an interesting approach that has come about. And you've been working in China, is that right?
Yeah, that's true. And just to pick up a little bit what Peter said, I mean, I think that's been a really interesting process, and I'll get back to that. But I also think it's important to tell a little bit about how we also felt that the idea of Danish design also over the years got more and more simplified, in the sense that, you know, an iconic Scandinavian chair would be very minimalistic and light wood with a soft seat of leather. You know, I mean, there was this perception of Danish design which we couldn't really recognize when you look back, because when you look back at the icons of Finn Juhl and Wiener and Kerholm and Arne Jacobsen, they are actually very playful and very diverse and very daring in many ways. And we actually felt that what was happening over the years was that Danish design got more and more simplified and actually lost its personality in a way. And that's, of course, something that we've been trying to work a little bit with ourselves, to try to find that curiosity again, and also allow ourselves to think beauty, to think aesthetics, to think ornament, to think all these things that you wouldn't normally connect with Danish design.
I'm afraid we're going to have to finish there, but to go back to your project in China, we've actually done a story on it in the next issue of Monocle. Yes.
Well, the thing is that where Sine sort of left off there, this the interesting thing about this, the China project, it's not just about China, it's about working in Asia, but this specific constellation is something that I think we'll see more of. It's a constellation where people from different cultural backgrounds sort of unite in fulfilling a dream of doing a specific thing. So in this specific case, it has some Japanese people involved in the ownership structure, and sort of the values involved from the Japanese culture combined with some French third generation upholstery qualities. And then they were before we got involved, they were infatuated by Scandinavian sort of the filter mechanism of the Scandinavian way of viewing different impressions. So they wanted a Scandinavian design team to sort of help reading Asian culture. And that's a little bit about what we find exciting. It's about getting this assignment where you kind of the brief is that you want to do an imprint of Asian culture, but you need it filtered by someone outside. And I think that whole thing has been incredibly satisfying to be a part of.
Well, you can read a lot more about that process and see the collection in the next issue of Monocle, which comes out next week. So thank you very much for joining us. And
no,
I hope that we'll hear a lot more from you in the future, definitely.
Thanks a lot.
We're at the bottom of the hour here on Midori House on Monocle 24. In the next half hour, we'll be hearing from Sarah Ichioka, director of the Architecture Foundation, about how to design the perfect urban beehive. We'll also be keeping things sweet with a visit from the chairman of the North London Beekeepers Association. Before that, we're off to Hong Kong to hear from the Urban Age Conference, a summit dedicated to improving city life. But first, the news headlines with Nick Kelly.
Thanks very much, Hugo. Mario Monti has formed a new technocrat government in Italy to tackle a major debt crisis threatening the entire eurozone, and said he hoped it would placate financial markets. France and Germany have clashed over whether the European Central Bank should intervene more forcefully to halt the eurozone's accelerating debt crisis after modest bond purchases failed to stop the rout. Eurogroup head Jean-Claude Juncker was quoted in a German newspaper saying that Germany's debt level is worrying and even higher than Spain's. The only immediate solution to the eurozone crisis is for the European Central Bank to step in as the ultimate backstop, because the bloc's rescue fund has failed to convince markets and EU treaty changes would take too long, the Irish Prime Minister Enda Kenny told Reuters today. France recalled its ambassador to Damascus and Syria's suspension from the Arab League took effect, intensifying diplomatic pressure on President Bashar al-Assad to halt an eight-month-old crackdown on protests. Libya's wartime rebel prime minister said his country faces a lengthy and dangerous power vacuum where foreign powers may exploit rival militias on the streets, and he called for a dramatic acceleration in plans for full elections. Embattled ANC Youth League leader Julius Malema said he was a victim of a witch hunt by some top members of South Africa's ruling party who want him out to silence his calls to nationalise mines and seize white-owned farmland. And European countries topped a list of the world's nations with the most robust energy and climate policies, the World Energy Council said in a report, mainly due to ambitious European Union emissions cuts and renewable targets. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Nick. You're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. Now, Hong Kong is currently playing host to the Urban Age Conference, organised by the London School of Economics. The theme is Cities, Health and Wellbeing, and the attendees are putting Hong Kong under the spotlight as they ask whether a super-dense city can be good for your health and how much space you need to be happy. Earlier, our editor Andrew Tuck caught up with Christine Lowe, Chief Executive of Civic Exchange Hong Kong, to ask whether Hong Kong works.
Christine, the first question I wanted to ask you, obviously Urban Age is taking place in Hong Kong this year for a very specific reason. It's looking at the connection between well-being, quality of life, and living in a city as dense as Hong Kong. For you, what are the key challenges really facing Hong Kong if it wants to deliver quality of life?
One of the major issues being discussed at the conference is what is the impact of high density? There's a sort of an assumption that if density is very high, this has got to be a very negative thing because people don't like to live very close to each other, you know, that there's a certain very high level of crowdiness. However, the research that we've seen now, not just from Hong Kong, but from other parts of the world, is density on its own is not necessarily a problem. And when you have a very high density city like in Hong Kong, where buildings are very tall, people are very close to each other, if public transport is good, if people have a sense of community, these are also things that ameliorate the situation. And in Hong Kong, for example, we rank very high in terms of longevity, child mortality, and, you know, basically people feeling safe in the city and that they have access to all kinds of amenities. And these serve Hong Kong very well.
Now, Hong Kong is also known as a very peaceful city in many ways. And as you say, there is this real sense of community. Now, do you think that means that density works well only in certain societies? Is there something cultural about Hong Kong that makes its density work?
I think this is an issue that is being explored. We're not entirely sure how this works out. And one of our experts today gave a very interesting contrast to a piece of research where they looked at residents in New York City and residents in Hong Kong. So whilst looking at the objective data, Hong Kong people are actually more healthy than people in New York. However, when you ask people in the two cities how they look at their health, their self-reporting, their self-perception of health, Hong Kong people think they're much sicker or not as well as people in New York. So the question really is, we don't quite know what the answer is, but perhaps culture and what people are used to is an important factor.
Now, obviously, Hong Kong is an interesting example because it's not just density in the number of people who say live in a block or in an apartment building. It's not just the height of them. In fact, many of the apartments are also quite small for Western standards. Again, is that something you're interested in discovering, whether that impacts on people's health, how much space actually people do need to live?
Well, we are extremely small. You know, people are living in flats as small as 150 square feet in size. And even our larger apartments are small by Western standards. So it is something that we're used to. We're not saying that that is good. And when you have small spaces and very crowded, one of the things that becomes very important is public open spaces, because that's where people have to go to recreate. However, this is an area where I don't think Hong Kong is doing nearly as well as it could. However, there is another balancing factor, which is that 40% of Hong Kong is actually what we call country parks. So there's a lot of open area that is quite attractive, that is actually very near the city. The Chinese for a long time didn't actually go hiking in great numbers, but in the last 10 years or so, younger people have taken to doing things in the countryside. So I think there's people's culture and practices can also change over time.
I know that one of the themes that's coming up at the conference is happiness and whether cities can actually make us happy. It's quite an interesting subject because I know that lots of city governments and national governments around the world are concerned that actually in kind of shaky economic times, it's actually better to have happy citizens perhaps rather than worrying about how much money they have. But do you think a city can really plan for happiness?
I think it's important to talk about what we mean by happiness. There are two portions to it. One is the physical side, you know, what kind of conditions you live in. And certainly if you've got the reasonable provision of healthcare services, if your surrounding areas are reasonably pleasant and you feel safe in the city, and if you feel also there is a social safety net in your city, these things contribute greatly to people not feeling a high sense, a high sense of stress. And that is a very important determining factor to how people feel. Then, of course, there is the internal side, where an individual might be in their lives. But overall, I think if we're talking about the more external side, then having basic provisions of public services, being near transportation, seems to be very important to people in Hong Kong.
Now, the Hong Kong authorities have always been, over recent years, very careful about migration into the city, into Hong Kong. Is this another important thing to think about when you're talking about cities? Because I wonder if one of the reasons Hong Kong is successful is that it does have this, as you say, this incredible social cohesion. Is that a balancing act for, you know, any country or any city that obviously needs new migrants to kind of boost business, to generate income? But on the other side, you know, as you let more and more people in, this sense of social cohesion, especially in very dense buildings, begins to collapse.
This is an interesting question. We are mainly ethnic Chinese, but actually we have had enormous migration, and migration is still happening from mainland China to here. So whilst this is not a different ethnicity, however, the migration coming from a very, very large country, it's also considered a kind of migration. And there are cultural differences between people in different parts of China. So this has always been a major thing. And we do have many tens of thousands of people from mainland China still coming to Hong Kong every year. So this does require active policies of integration.
And Christine, can I finally just ask you, what's the general buzz there at the conference about Hong Kong? Do you think that people do look at Hong Kong as actually quite a shiny example of how you can run a dense city and successfully? Or do you think that people are beginning to be more concerned about the challenges facing Hong Kong?
People coming from outside Hong Kong are very impressed with Hong Kong because we do live in such high density and that it is generally a peaceful and reasonably harmonious city. I think there are things to learn from this. One that people keep repeating is the very good provision of public transportation, because people want that a lot. So especially if you are low income, you don't want to be disadvantaged by not being able to move around the city. And focus groups, interviews have shown that this is extraordinarily important. So that's one thing that people from outside have learned, that it is possible to provide good public amenities to maintain social harmony.
Christine Lowe, thank you so much for taking time out of the conference to join us today.
That was Christine Lowe, Chief Executive of Civic Exchange Hong Kong, talking to our editor, Andrew Tuck, earlier today. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We'll be back in a second.
In the new issue of Monocle, we ranked the world's soft superpowers.
The UK and France were the first joint winners of our soft power survey last year. This time around, who won? Well, you'll just have to see. But we had more countries, we had more metrics, and we had a few extra special surprises.
We survey the state of Denmark in a 36-page supplement.
For the Monocle Denmark survey, we went beyond Copenhagen, looked beyond bicycles, the Tivoli Gardens and island living, to meet the people, places and businesses who really drive modern Denmark.
In the design section, we took a trip around London to see how all the Olympic commissions are using London's homegrown talent. And we also went to an island haven in the Swedish archipelago and did a bit of skinny dipping.
And we also have our picks of the 100 people, places and products you need to meet, see and sample in 2012. All that, plus our travel top 50, our holiday gift guide, and a trip to the borderlands of China and Russia in the December-January issue of Monocle. On newsstands now or via subscription at monocle.com.
You're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24. Time for a little bit of music. This is Babylon by David Gray. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Midori House's Studio One with me, Hugo MacDonald. Now, they're the scourge of a school classroom or a summer family picnic, but they also sweeten up our breakfast toast too. Bees have previously endured an unfairly weighted love-hate relationship with the regular city softy. But this is set to change with the rise of urban beekeeping. So much so that the Architecture Foundation recently launched a competition to design a practical beehive for urban spaces. Joining me now is Director of the Architecture Foundation, Sarah Ichioka, and Chairman of the North London Beekeepers Association, Malcolm Bolston. Sarah and Malcolm, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Sarah, I wonder if you could start by telling us a little bit about where the idea for this competition for an urban beehive came from.
Well, we as an organization have been really interested in how design can help welcome biodiversity back to the city center. And it's been evident in a number of projects we've done over the last 2 years. But the idea for this competition really came out through conversations with Tas Mavrogordato, who's the chief executive of In Midtown Business Improvement District. And you wouldn't immediately think of a business improvement district, a BID, as a kind of hippie, nature-loving sort. But actually, Tas is really plugged in, really interested in the role that creativity can play in positioning the Business Improvement District. And just through conversation, essentially, I found out that she's been supporting a program called In Midtown Buzz, which encourages urban beekeeping on the roofs of several of the businesses in the area. And we together came up with the idea of a competition that would expand from that to look at both a bespoke hive for the Business Improvement District, as in addition, a suite of other designs that would support other species. So
it's not just bees.
Bees and, it's bees and, so bees and birds, bats, and also planters that can support the plant forage that supports all of these animals.
And Malcolm, why is there a need to have bees in the city?
Well, they pollinate all the flowers and trees and plants in the city. They create a huge amount of benefit to the cityscape. Without them, we wouldn't have half as much to look at in the parks, really, apart from which they make the most delicious honey.
I know, and we've got some honey here. Which does this come from the bees that you keep?
Indeed, yes. It comes from my own garden, yeah.
Gosh, and, I mean, is it difficult to keep bees in the city? Or is it? We've seen a lot of... in fact, we've done a few stories in the past in Monocle about various schemes in different cities around the world for urban beekeeping. And... I mean, it seems to me that you can do it with very little space.
Indeed, yes. People keep bees on balconies, on estates and things like that. You do have to be a little bit considerate of your neighbours. but the bees themselves will get on and they just fly out and up.
Yeah.
So you don't really see them that much. Once they've left the hive, they're away. So a little bit of consideration and informing your neighbours what's going on, keep them educated, because a swarm of bees is quite frightening to the uninitiated.
Absolutely, or to the allergic.
Or the allergic. But so is a peanut sandwich.
Well, I know, of course, we're surrounded by fatal dangers every day. But Sarah, why is there a need for a specially designed beehive for an urban environment?
Well, I think what's really interesting is, just chatting with Malcolm earlier, so much of what he and his colleagues do really center on a domestic sphere. So it's kind of the hive at the back of the garden, this really idyllic kind of English suburban idea. And I think what we really wanted to do within Midtown is look at how we can bring this into the very center of our cities and also move it to a, maybe kind of a high-rise office typology as well. And clearly there are different conditions that come when you bring the hives up to a higher level, for example.
Very much. You get a lot of wind and things like that.
Exactly.
And so you've just recently launched the competition. Have you had sort of entries sent in already? What's the response been like?
Indeed, it's been really, really positive. And there's been a lot of online dialogue about it. I might mention as well that we've been curating the exhibition in partnership with an artist and architect called Fritz Haig, who's been really interested in initiating a lot of projects that he calls animal estates. So essentially treating the animal as a client in the same way you might treat a human being as a client for a building.
What kind of an animal would make an easier or more difficult client?
Depends on the client you're talking about.
Brilliant. And when's the closing date for entries?
I'm really glad that we're talking to you right now, because just a few days remain, actually, for people from around the world to submit their designs. Registration closes on the 23rd of November, and then 5 days later on the 28th, submissions are due.
Right. Well, we've got a pot of honey in front of us, and I want to... Actually, before I taste it, I just want to ask Malcolm, this is probably very naive of me, but honey that comes from a city, is it polluted in any way?
No, it's not. The bees are extremely good at selecting the nectar that they bring back and turn into the honey. And samples of honey have been tested for what you might expect, like diesel particulates and things like that. And actually, they don't come into it in any shape or form. So it's a very pure food. And London benefits greatly from not having so much pesticide as the countryside. I mean, people may spray the odd little bit of their garden, but in general, their trees and gardens and parks aren't sprayed with anything.
So actually the honey could be purer.
So the honey could in fact be purer. And the bees are probably better off in the city than they are in the countryside. They have much, much more to forage on through a much longer period of the year. Whereas in the country, they might only have one crop, and then there's nothing. And the
so they're actually much more productive in the city?
Not much more productive, but they're productive over a longer period. So they have less food, but it's spread out over the year.
And more consistent.
It's more, and of course, every plant has a different nectar, so it's a much more complex product from the city than it is in the countryside.
Well, I can't wait to try it. So would you mind passing me, maybe pass the tray rather than a teaspoon of honey on it?
Yeah.
Otherwise, Tyler might have a heart attack if he sees honey drizzled all over the new studios. And you notice that there's been a massive... surge in interest in beekeeping.
Yes,
in London.
There has, and we have problems in running enough courses to satisfy.
It's very sweet.
To satisfy the demand, it's not enough just to run a course and teach people. You need to be able to follow that up, so that if they really want to become involved, they've got the backup. There are a lot of people running courses. And then they run the course and they don't want to see you anymore. So it's but an organisation, a proper organisation, then has the facilities to make sure that the people get brought on and improve their beekeeping.
Sustainable training.
Important.
This is absolutely delicious.
Do you have apricot trees?
It tastes very fruity.
Well,
it's
very complicated. Yeah, it's very complex flavours. But
Well done.
Well done the bees.
Well done the bees, and well done London for producing such a complex flavoured honey.
Yeah. Definitely the best.
It's a nice metaphor, isn't it?
I know. I'm not going to get into metaphors too much. I just also wanted to find out, in terms of the training, if I wanted to be a beekeeper, I'd come to you and do a course?
Yes, we run a course in the winter, which is over a sort of period of evenings, a couple of hours.
in an evening over a number of weeks, and then and that just explains and introduces you to it, really. And then in the spring, when the bees have started to get active again, then we have a training apiary, and the new beekeepers will come on there and actually get some hands-on experience, and then follow the season through, so you see every single aspect of what happens in a bee year. Right the way through till October, November, when they've all gone back into their hives for the winter. But by doing that, you really get a much better sort of feel for what you need to do.
Wonderful. Gosh, I've learned so much in the space of the last 5 minutes. Thank you very, very much for joining me, Sarah and Malcolm. Now, keeping on the, well, vague honey theme, we've got Sweet Disposition by Temper Trap up next.
Sweet.
And that's all from us here at Midori House. Today's show was produced by Gillian DeBias. Our researcher was Tom Hall. And our studio manager was Anna Veal. Nick Kelly is coming up soon with the headlines in just a moment. Then at the top of the hour, it's time for The Entrepreneurs with Jonathan Openshaw. You've been listening to me, Hugo MacDonald. Thank you. Bye-bye.